Guardian Unlimited.
Without further ado, can you please welcome the artists, please, Gilbert and George. Thank you. The first thing that struck me when I saw the show last week was you've actually created your city. It is Gilbert and George world, finally. You seem to have put everything in there.
It is quite extraordinary, because we know that every artist in the world has the dream of exhibiting in this, now the most famous museum in the world for modern art. And for us, it is a reality. That is quite amazing.
After all, it took us 7 years to get here. 7 years. Intensity beyond belief.
And 7 years to actually get
this. Yes, it was 7 years when we first asked if they would like a show of us here. And they said for many years, no.
And did they give reasons for the resounding no?
Of course, because the division of the Tate into Tate Modern and Tate Britain, which I think took place in 2000 or 2001, a big mistake was made. They divided it by nationality, with Tate Britain and Tate Modern, almost by passport. And we think in a modern age that is completely wrong. You cannot do art by passport. They should have done it by chronology, by 1900 or 1950. Then it would be very fair, and we think it's a kind of apartheid to have a museum where British artists have to go and overseas ones in another building. Especially because Britain has the most cosmological group of artists in the whole world. If you go to Germany, most artists will be German. If you go to France, most artists will be French. In Britain, that hasn't been the case for many, many years. Francis Bacon was born in Ireland, Lucien Freud was born in Germany, Gilbert was born in Italy. All the artists come from all over the world.
You also, it has to be said, just to get this thorny question over with, you were slightly miffed at the length of time it took before you were granted a retrospective at all.
Well, we think it happened just right in the end. We overcame the problems. Very good.
And logistically, how difficult was it to put this show together?
I mean, we did the planning, we did the design, we did what you call, we put in all what you call our ideas to make a G&G world, a total circle. At the beginning and an end, we made that.
It had to be an enormous decision in the detailing of the show, because retrospectives of living artists are extremely rare, and that is very rarely realized. The last retrospective we had in Britain was in 1981, so very few of those people will still be alive in order to see the second retrospective. And many of the people who will see this one wouldn't have been alive in 1981, so this will be the first retrospective. So it's not like sport or murder or politics. It's not every day in every newspaper. Access to modern living art in that way is extremely rare.
And for us, it was very important to take away the views and polls.
We didn't
want
to. We
are very jealous artists, so we didn't want that competition on the other side.
All of the people involved in the day, they love the views through from the gallery to the city. And we convinced them finally by saying, we think London is such an ugly city, it's much better to block the views of it. They said, okay. Yeah.
Well, they have their own, they have Gilbert and George's London now, really, don't they?
Yeah, you can always go to the cafe and the restaurant to see the views.
And you've also, quite surprisingly to me, embraced branding in a big way. I don't know if the shop was open tonight, but among other things, you can buy a Gilbert and George sin box.
The swear box is very important for us.
Yeah.
It's very good. We designed the swear box, and we said to the merchandising department, would they like to do it? And they said, yes, for no other reason than there's no other artist you could do a swear box for.
And could you describe it to people who haven't seen it?
It's very good. It's just a little wooden box. Not all countries have swear boxes, it seems. Maybe countries that have confession boxes don't have swear boxes. And the countries that don't have confessional boxes need swear boxes. But we're not sure of that. It would be an interesting research to do. So it just says on the front, the Gilbert and George swear box, and then there are swear words all over, but they're all with the asterisks. It's a polite swear box. And on the back it says, pay up and F off.
The other thing we have to talk about was Friday's apocalyptic review. Most of the reviews have been quite good, but Brian Sewell, true to form, I think he excelled himself.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know how many of you saw the Evening Standard, but it was quite extraordinary.
It was amazing.
Burst of apoplexy.
They chose all of our pictures to illustrate the article with the intention to incriminate us. But of course, it has the reverse effect. It's rather like walking through the West End and seeing a cinema where the hoarding says, "This is the filthiest film ever made that you will ever see." The only chance would be to join the queue, I'm sure. So for the Evening Standard, it was a double middle page spread, and it had spunk, blood, tears, spit. Then it had the Dirty Words picture, fuck. Then it had shitted. Then it had the one with the boys. And then it had the magazine sculpture with the George the Shit and George the Cunt. So they excel themselves. I don't think that article will keep many people away from the exhibition.
One of the things you said outside, though, was that you, given that he's such an extraordinary writer in a way, you probably would like him. You probably would get on.
I'm sure people would love him.
Yeah.
But he wants to be, what do you call, confronting us all the time with, but he loves what you call dirty words. He himself only writes dirty words when he talks about us. But we are the only artist that he can attack. He cannot attack an abstract artist. He wouldn't know what to say.
Just to illustrate the point, actually, this was an earlier review, which you kept all the words and read them out to me.
This is a review where we just took out the words that meant something. We left out all the and, of, with.
Yeah.
The result is
okay. Tossers, dirty, unkempt, low life, lavatory, ejaculation, emptying bowels, bladder, anus, sodomalinus. Schoolboy smut, bilge, blasphemy, and my own personal favourite, tapioca de wanker. Which, as you say, is almost art.
I think it's extraordinary, yes.
Well, it's interesting because continental or overseas people in general, they think he's an amazing phenomenon. They say, we could not have this in our country. Extraordinary.
Yeah. You didn't happen to be at the show when he arrived? No.
No.
We never saw him.
We never met him, actually.
Did he like anything about the show?
I think he likes a lot of things in the show, but he doesn't want people to know that.
Yeah.
I think that's the secret. Yeah.
We just wandered through the show beforehand, and one of the things that George was saying was, initially when you were known as controversial artists in the 70s, one of the things that it rested on was your use of rent boys in the
pictures.
And when I looked through Google, three or four of the reviews actually said this, and of course they weren't rent boys at all.
Not as far as we know.
Oh. Yeah. And even I mean, if they were.
How would we say to someone who came to model for us, "Are you on the game?" It's an absurd idea.
Yeah.
It was actually the Independent, I forgot the name of the writer now, they illustrated one of the articles 10, 15 years ago with a beautiful picture of ours, Doom, which is a very solemn, serious picture with this huge rain-sodden manhole cover coming out of a dark sky in a ring and four young people in the foreground. And he described them as rent boys. And I telephoned and said, what makes you say they're rent boys? Oh, well, couldn't answer at all. I said, I'm sure you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a rent boy and a non-rent boy on the streets of the West End. Oh, I said, I could tell you, but you wouldn't know the difference. So it is a sort of classist thing.
Yeah.
Another thing they always used to say was a bunch of East End yobs. Mm. Well, what if they were? But in fact, they're not. Yeah.
They
come from all walks of life and from all countries in the world. Yeah.
After all, it's quite a very big tradition of prostitutes in art. 19th century, late 19th century.
Yeah, yeah.
All the artists use them for models. No?
Yeah.
We actually don't, but they use them.
You seldom talk about influences, just when you're now talking about pictures and artists, but is that part of the strategy of being Gilbert and George, not to deny all knowledge of any
other artists?
Yeah.
We can say names of favourite artists, but we don't like when people say, ah, yes, that's
here we go again. Yeah. I mean, we were influenced when we were young, like every other artist, not. But recently we tried to do the art in front of an empty space. That's what we like. We don't like to be contaminated by art. That's what we always say. So that's why we don't go to shows anymore, we don't go to museums anymore, we don't talk to artists anymore, we just are completely naked in front of the world.
It's very difficult, that influence thing, because it's like the famous story from Henry Moore, which I remember hearing as an art student, being interviewed by a journalist at his house, and then the journalist noticing on his way out a huge collection of strange-shaped pebbles in the front of the house, And the journalist saying, oh, so that's where you get the ideas from your sculptures, is it? And Henry Moore said, I only collect pebbles that look like my sculptures. Which I'm sure was the case.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. I know you also don't like talking too much about your personal life and stuff, but could we talk about briefly when you first came together at St. Martin's? And
1967.
Yeah.
I think we do talk more about our personal life in our art than any other artist we know. But it was 1967, St. Martin's School of Art.
And it was quite exciting.
What did you tell me?
Because I arrived in London with a big suitcase and I camped in front of St. Martin's School of Art until they let me in, and it was amazing. And Philip King, he said yes. And so I went up to the top floor where all these crazy artists were there, George, Richard Long, Hamish Fulton, Barry Flanagan, and George was the only one who was interested in me. That's how it started, yes.
Does that chime with your remembrance?
I mean, it was an extraordinary time because it wasn't St. Martin's School of Art for us. It was the advanced sculpture course at St. Martin's School of Art, which is at the top of the college. We weren't aware of any other department. I never saw the painting department, which we had after we left college, they did have.
Yeah.
We were very arrogant, and it was very elitist.
Even it was very good because in some way we changed the way of sculpture. Because at that time, sculpture meant forms, not painted squares, painted cubes, painted sticks, something like that. No? And we wanted to get away from that to make what we call like a living arts, living sculptures. Ourselves make the center of our art, no? And take away everything.
We wanted a human art, an art with content and meaning. And all of the tradition of the younger generation sculptors, as they were called, were against that. I remember that there used to be something called a crit every week where the students would go from sculpture to sculpture and talk about it, but it was only in terms of weight, colour and shape. And there was one artist one week who did a sculpture with a sort of cornucopia abstract with a lot of oranges falling out. If he'd been to the market, bought a box of oranges and put them in. And they discussed this in completely terms of colour and shape. And then I said, are they outspans or Jaffas? Ah, they got mad. Because it was the time of apartheid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Extraordinary. Yeah. They didn't like that.
No.
Because they must have been one or the other.
So when you went out, and there's that extraordinary image of you shot from behind, literally underneath the arches, performing underneath the arches. Well, can you remember what the reactions were when you went out among the public?
Ah, we did it first in St. Martin's School of Art. And it was quite good because we went there and asked them if they would do it. And we did such a big campaign the whole week. We promoted this idea of a new sculpture with giving away cigarettes, giving away marshmallows and all the stuff. That when it came to what called the Friday afternoon, everybody was there. And it was amazing.
Strong.
How long did it last?
Only lasted 5 minutes.
And we did the publicity campaign because we were always very disappointed. The Friday afternoons was invariably a visiting lecturer. So you would go down on Friday afternoon and there would be Richard Hamilton talking. Extraordinary, this famous artist to us as students, with 11 students there listening. We thought that was horrible and very disappointing. So we filled the hall and we began the sculpture underneath the arches. We dream our dreams away.
And in the middle
of the sculpture, the head of department, the most famous person in the whole building, Frank Martin, the late Frank Martin, stomped out very noisily from the hall, which made all the students admire the sculpture even more, and gave a very clear sign to us as well. That living piece meant something.
Yeah.
Not approving.
Yeah.
No, and after that, we never went back to St. Martin's School of Art, ever.
We were a little unsure of our interpretation of that. We thought maybe we'd be called away to answer the telephone. So just to make sure, we telephoned a lady friend of ours who lived in the north of England and said, please write a letter to Frank Martin saying you're considering doing some project with us and he would recommend us, wouldn't he? Yeah? And back came a letter which she forwarded to us saying, dear madam, under no circumstances have anything to do with these people. And then we knew.
Then we knew exactly what to do.
And did you, from the start, decide to confront people and to provoke people?
Oh no, the singing schedule was fantastic. Everybody was crying in front of it. It's unbelievable. When we did it in Düsseldorf and like in New York, it was like they were totally entranced in front of it. For days and days and days, they were not able to leave. It was like a mad world in front of them. Totally fantastic.
Yeah. It was a crazy, crazy time. We did the singing sculpture in Brussels in a very little known temporary gallery in 1970. And at the end of the evening, a little lady who we thought was rather elderly came up and said, "My name is Ileana Sonneben, and I'm opening a gallery in New York, and I want you to do the first exhibition." This was an extremely famous Ileana Sonneben. Her husband was Leo Castelli, and she was opening a gallery downtown, 420 West Broadway. It was a block of galleries in a very wretched part of New York. And most of the pundits said, you know, within a year or two, maybe it'll catch on, having galleries in that poor part of New York. No, no, it was that one Saturday that the galleries opened. It was an immediate success and became a success. Now it's all finished, it's all moved to Chelsea. But for years, Soho was an international place for art. In fact, the police department was called out because all the streets were blocked with people. They didn't know what was happening. It was an amazing time.
It was amazing. It was so extraordinary because we went there. We were quite unknown artists. And we were invited every night to different apartments with very famous artists like Rauschenberg and all these people. Going out, they were cooking for us. They were so friendly towards us. And every night we went out drinking the whole night with all the artists. What was the club called?
Maxis Candy City.
And all the artists were there at that time. Whole night drinking and dancing, and next day doing the singing for 8 hours non-stop. We did it for 2 weeks. And it was extraordinary.
Totally mental.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Even it was a kind of different art world. It was a very small art world. It was like a small, like a family. You know?
Yeah.
Everybody knew each other. One gallery, let's say in Holland, one in Germany, one in Italy, one in Paris, one in New York, one in London, Nigel Greenwood, and so on.
Tiny
art world. Very, what you call, it was quite difficult sell out at that time. But everybody was very happy.
And can we talk about the drinking years and the drinking sculptures where you sort of seem to embrace?
After all, we went to Düsseldorf with this new sculpture called, the drawing piece.
Walking,
viewing, relaxing. Because we thought we have to leave something behind, you know? We cannot be there forever. And we make these drawings. Every day we were experimenting a new way. We made these drawings like an installation drawing. And Conor Fisher asked us, "So how much do you want for this?" And we said, £1,000.
We didn't dream that somebody would buy it.
We just said it.
We might as well be extravagant. if nobody's going to buy it, it might as well be £1,000. Enormous amount of money at that time. Yeah. And amazingly, the next day he sold it.
He sold it. That was it.
It was enough money to live for a year at that time.
That's when you start to drink.
Beginning of the end. And we realised that at that time, we were very socially involved in artists, both in London and Europe and in New York. And we would all be celebrating together and dancing the night away and drinking the night away. All sorts of crazy bad behaviour. And the artists were going back the next day to the studio to do the perfect line or circle. and we thought, let's do the art about what we were doing last night. Let's be truthful. Let's be honest. Yeah? That's the subject.
So we did the drinking subject.
It's a worldwide subject. It's a worldwide problem, many people think. Hmm? It's a political problem. It's a religious problem. It's a family problem.
So you actually sat about it with some dedication.
Yeah, we wanted to explore the whole idea of alcohol and getting drunk in other ways as well. We even did pictures drunk with God. People can be completely drunk with other forms as well.
And how long did this last, this intoxicating?
It didn't leave us completely.
How long has it lasted so far?
I don't know if you saw that Gordon Byrne published an article that he had written.
Oh yes, that's extraordinary. It was rather amusing.
In 73,
that hadn't actually been published
before. Well, it showed you the, I mean, you were falling down.
I'm sure we were, yeah.
Well, he got the sack.
Yeah, it was his first job and he got the sack. Yeah. He basically got so drunk he couldn't write the piece.
Yeah.
Which, well, now it's published. It's, yeah. It's rather amusing.
Yeah. And how seriously, did it open you up? Did it affect your art? Did it make you different artists?
I mean, it was extraordinary because we were able to explore that subject, and at the same time we realised, looking back, that 60 or 70% of the people on the streets of our district were drunks or tramps
or misfits, homosexuals.
Because there were these huge hostels for men. There was a Catholic one, there was the Salvation Army, there was another one. So most of the people we saw on the street were not working, they were tramps. And we remember that in 1972 or 3, the Salvation Army asked, I think it was Oxford or Cambridge University, to do a report to see how they should behave for the future. You know, what the future for, what sort of tramps there would be in the future, whether there would be any.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they did a huge research. It was quite an extraordinary result. 67% of the people who were in hostels in London were there because they'd committed some minor sexual offence in the small town or village where they'd lived and had been told by the local police that they would be charged the next morning or clear off. So they wouldn't be able to say anything to their families, they wouldn't even be able to pack much, they would just have to leave town. I think the rest of the percentage were people who'd been damaged in the last war. So it's extraordinarily tragic. Of course, those people are not with us anymore. Now the people in hostels are mainly to do with drugs rather than drink.
Yeah. And you said at that time, around the end of the 70s, I think it was, that you wanted to be among the outsiders.
We still are.
We always were in some way.
Oh, yes, we always are. We always have been.
And by then, but did you mean people like that, that you wanted to sort of...
Yes,
they were with us.
Yes. Yeah. That's why Underneath the Arches is exactly that, yes. Yeah. And we always felt, yes, outsiders. Even East End of London was at that time quite an amazing rundown district. Fantastic. It was like moving into a Dickens film, but it was amazing, extreme in the same way. All immigrants.
We love
Jewish immigrants.
And quite a threatening place in certain, I remember in the
city. Very rough, very dark. At that time there was nowhere to go locally in the evenings. If you wanted to clubs or anything, we had to go to the West End. And invariably to ask a taxi to go to Fournier Street, invariably the reply from the driver would be, "What do you want to go there for, Gov? What's your game?" You know, they were suspicious. And if you said you lived there, they'd be even more amazed.
And sometimes we used to go to Richard Street. You know, there were some pubs there, and we used to end up dancing with the lorry drivers. You know?
There were huge lorry parks.
Yeah, and then we left out of the blue, and they would follow us and chuck stones through the windows.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And did you get beaten up a few times? I think. No?
Not so much.
No.
Once in Finsbury Park, I think.
Yeah.
A couple of muggings, but everyone's been mugged in London, more or less. Yeah.
But you have somehow, when you walk through the exhibition, I mean, you have mapped out that area as much as any writer in a strange way. I mean, the whole psychogeography of the East.
Oh, yes, we are feeling. We feel in the district again and again. Even recently for us, it's more extreme and more interesting because you have what you call Church of England on one side and you had the mosque on the other side. No? And that's unbelievable. And we always used to collect these little stickers that are on the lamppost. No? Yeah, and you can feel what's going next and what's coming up next. No? Because all the messages are already there.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
But a lot of the messages are also in your work.
They're from the stick and stuff like that.
I think it is mapping our district, but it's also mapping the Western world, because roughly what's happening in the East End of London happens a little later in the world, and it is a tiny example of what's roughly the world, and it's the Western psyche in a way.
So when you first moved there, it was, what kind of a neighbourhood was it?
Was it
still the rag trade there?
Totally Jewish. Rag trade, farriers. And
two Indian restaurants
on Brick Lane. One we used to go to called the Clifton. We were the only white people who ate there, except for the police who used to go in for a free
meals.
Takeaway. And being an innocent country boy, I agonized over whether to report them. And then there was another one which was even poorer. It was so run down that more than three or four times we were sitting there eating our meal and a tramp would break into the restaurant and grab a handful of food and run out. You'd actually steal a meal off the table. It's unthinkable today. Yeah? Mm. Unthinkable.
But we are a fantastic place.
And everything changed. The off-license was Jewish at that time. Yes, all the newsagents were.
Strudel shops.
Then a little old lady who just cooked strudel, Mrs. Berman. Then it became briefly Maltese, with people keeping ferrets in all the houses. Alsatian dogs playing cards all day. Just opposite us in 40th Street, there was a Maltese cafe. Very nice. Then it became more city people and then more families. And
artistic now. It's all artists.
And yet all still
artists. There are so many artists around us, circling us. So many.
Yeah.
Even every shop has changed. Even amazingly, the public lavatories. One has become a club outside of the church.
That's right, yeah.
And the one on Whitechapel has become an Indian restaurant until recently. Some young friends were saying, you must try it. It's delicious food. And the staff are very kind. And it's eat-in or take-away. I said, it always was.
And your cafe has gone, sadly.
Oh, yes.
Finally, the market cafe.
The market cafe. He was the only true genius that we met. He was unbelievable.
The chef.
Yes. Clyde was a gentle person, but he was such a genius in cooking. He was just unbelievable.
So now
we admire him more than anybody else.
Do you now trek still across to Stoke Newington to the Turkish?
Oh, that's for the evenings. Yes.
But you still walk
every night.
Yeah.
Separately.
Yes.
Yep. Because I do a slightly longer walk. I do an hour and a half. Gilbert does 45 minutes.
But this, you each do the same walk each night, or do you vary your walks?
No, same one.
Same one.
It's very good because we arrive exactly at 8 o'clock, and occasionally when we arrive 1 minute early or 1 minute. And the waiters say, what's happened? Where's Mr. Gilbert?
It's very sweet.
And can I ask why you do that?
Oh, we
relaxing.
Love get out of the house, get out of the studio. We find it relaxing. It's good exercise. It's very relaxing. It's this barrage of information we love in the city. You see thousands of people, thousands of cars, thousands of shops, thousands of policemen and everything. It's wonderful.
And do you still record and collect the graffiti and stuff that you...
Yes, we do
sometimes.
That as well, yes.
Depends. Not all the time, depends. Sometimes.
No. Maybe we moved on towards something different, yes.
Yeah.
But you always collect images, all the time. We have a big bank of images. They're all in the computer. And we have an index to call them up, all in subjects.
So you take the camera with you wherever you go? Just
Not always, but for periods. Yeah. Yeah.
Because when sometimes there are periods, we only take images. We are periods that we don't make artworks. We only take images, and in subjects, towards certain subjects that interest us.
Yeah.
And we collect them and we put them all in the computer in the right order that we are able to call them up. If not, we would be lost.
I was quite interested in the graffiti because you talk, apart from the fact that you talk very fondly about some of the stuff over the years, but in the actual show, it's quite prescient, some of the stuff that was scrawled on walls.
Oh, it's extraordinary. We always feel that it's always brewing in our neighbourhood, that we can feel something bubbling. And we had text which we used in the huge quadripartite picture called 1999, text like, blow up Honkyland. Mm. Yeah? And that's what people did 2 or 3 years later. But that was a very strange text to find at that time. Yeah.
Even all these words that we used collectively, we didn't know what it meant, like Khalifa or Sharia law or apostasia. We didn't know what they meant exactly. Now everybody knows what they mean.
It became common currency. Even the picture we did in 1980 called Mullah, we did that because we wanted to be more inclusive, because we did a lot of dead king and tree Jesus and
mad and
the ones of Christ. So we thought we should have a Muslim one as well. So we did Mullah. And everybody asked us all the time, whenever it was exhibited, what is Mullah? What does Mullah mean? What is Mullah? Until September the 11th. Nobody's asked us that question since, because now everyone knows what a Mullah is. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah. And do you still get the extreme pamphlets and leaflets through the
letterbox? Oh, yes, we have them.
Yes.
So
we have a beautiful one now which says, it is an inevitability. There is no negotiation with Islam, no negotiation with Sharia law. It is only a short matter of time before the black flag of Islam flies over Downing Street. And they're handing that out by the thousand in front of
our house
in Brick Lane. Yeah. They even kicked 7 or 8 doors in of non-Muslims in the district. One Hindu lady and the rest were people like ourselves, white people. Not to rob or anything, just to say, get out of this district, this is a holy place.
And people have said, I mean, some of your critics have said that you have blasphemed against Christ and
no,
Christianity.
I don't believe in blaspheming, because we are free people. We don't believe. We are free to say whatever we want. In fact, we are quite against religion. Our big motto today is ban religion. It would do a lot. Would be much better. Can you imagine all the wars of today are all based on religions. That's it. All religious wars are going on, non-stop.
Or if you just bring all the religions under the same legal umbrella as ourselves, then it would be fine as well. If the Trades Description Act applied to the Church of England, it would be fine. They could make no more false claims. They'd have to make do like the rest of us, yeah? You cannot manufacture a beer or a jar of jam and say, drink this and you go to heaven. Yeah? Don't drink this and you go to hell. But they're allowed to say these things about their product.
It's quite amazing, the whole idea of religion. I mean, I was brought up religious, but more and more I think it's the biggest problem of the whole world is based on religion. They're all this amazing hatred towards each other. Even like, they always talk about integration. How? How can you integrate when it's not allowed? It's forbidden. You have to, what you call, you have to convert to Islam or a different religion. If not, you're not allowed to integrate.
And yet you have a strange, small, but sort of hardcore Church of England following, do you not?
We have a Church of England following.
You have vicars arriving.
Honorary Bangladeshis as well. We've lived long enough in a way. No?
Yes.
We feel like honorary Cockneys and honorary Bangladeshis.
We know them all.
You
we
said
know everybody.
You said earlier that most of the negativity you get is from critics. But when you're on the street, everything is
There's
love.
A huge, huge gulf between the vast general public and the art critics. We've never understood that exactly.
Because we have this slogan like death, hope, life, fear. And
death, hope, life, fear, sex, money, race, religion.
And we realize.
Now we've added two more.
Because we realize that there is so much hate, love and hate, going on at the same time.
So these are the two new words we've added to our small list.
A lot of art critics are. They hate us so much, it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
If not all the public, I mean, they love us. We're the amazing gulf.
Could I ask you, it's a very simple question, but it struck me when I was walking around, I mean, you're peering out at us from so many of the pieces, not all of them, but most of them, you've put yourself in the art, in those grids. Why do you recur so much in your own work?
We're there like every artist is, but we just took it one stage further. Like Van Gogh is always there. If you're in a museum, you don't say, come and look at this tree and a bit of grass. You say, come and look at this Van Gogh. Because you know it's Van Gogh speaking to you from the grave. At this very moment, in some other time zone, there are people looking at a Van Gogh painting and having amazing emotions. Because they know it's Van Gogh speaking to you. So it's like that, but we took it one stage further.
We made ourselves the artwork and the sculpture and the living person, and we are the speakers. And we are speaking like writing a letter to another person. That's it. It's us saying that.
Like you will never sign another name apart from your own when you write a letter. It doesn't matter who it's to, it'll always be your name.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm suddenly aware of the time, which has galloped on. We should throw it open.
Up to you.
Do we have to stop at 9?
If anyone has something to ask, you must feel free, of course.
Hang on, there's a microphone somewhere. And I think this is being recorded, so can you wait until you have the microphone in your hand before you ask the question? This guy, this was the first hand, the guy in the stripy t-shirt was the first hand.
Hi there. I was very impressed by your exhibition, and it was good to see, as you say, the whole spectrum of life reflected in it. You know, the piss and the shit and religion and politics and the underbelly of London life. The one omission was women. I don't think I saw any featured in your art. Is that a conscious decision? Is this a conscious decision?
Yes, of course. It's not entirely true, because you do see women in street scenes, but you're right, as you said. That is partly for many reasons, but one is that the history of modern art has been written by the male checkbook, and that's where it's always been. The woman has been the subject, yeah? every joke about modern art is, we've got another tin of flesh colour. There's this horrific imbalance. Even in auction houses, if a pair of canvases of a husband and wife from 1880 are sold, the picture of the lady with the vase of flowers fetches a much, much higher sum of money than the husband. You can hardly sell the husband. So we're trying to redress the balance a little bit. Also because the female image is all over the place. If you look at the top shelf of every newsagent's, there's one or two boys at the end who women don't even touch, yeah? And the rest is all girls. Yeah?
Even Ken Livingstone has to advertise himself with naked lady. What about the Sun? Every day they have to have the page three girls.
So it's because we're feminists we leave women out of the pictures.
Does that answer your question?
It also does mean that we do pictures for women as well. It means that women can see the male body as well.
Yeah? I think if we would have women, it would be normal. Normal, boring. But if we don't do that, you create another dimension.
That's why we're discussing it now. Yeah? It's very good. There's one other reason. I forgot what the other reason is. Oh, yes, the other reason is that we don't believe we're showing life or reflecting life. We're trying, in our small way, to form our tomorrows. You can't take one of the postcards of one of our pictures and go and find that in London. It doesn't exist. They're totally artificial. Yeah? Anybody else?
Following on from that, I noticed walking around that apart from the group scenes of people, and apart from, I think it was Mad, that the only sort of large, iconic individual pictures seemed to be of black youth. And I wondered whether that was something you were conscious
of. Not so many. I mean, yes, because we saw they have extraordinary faces. That's it. Like church, what is it called?
Black church face.
Yeah. There are two or three like that. Because they just have amazing visual faces that are extraordinary.
And there aren't,
Hedy is another one.
And there are none in the National, no pictures of black people in the National Gallery, unless it's slaves. And it's quite interesting that in the early 80s, we would very often be asked by journalists an ugly question which could never be asked today: why do you have black people in your pictures? No journalist would ask that today. That would be a horrific question.
Yes, but we did do a lot of other ones as well. They are just not in the show. No. Like Bun Hill Night, there are many like that. Just not in this show. Yes, because in some way we prefer the ones. That's it.
So women and blacks, the next minority group must be... They're coming up in a moment. Why don't you have any queers in your life?
I'm trying to find a woman. Yeah, there's a woman here.
I wanted to ask, do you still feel like outsiders now that you've had this enormous show? And if so, what do you feel outside of?
Now, it's very, very good because they asked us all about that. And we said, we are only inside for 3 months. After that, we're going to be outside again.
Back outside.
But I mean, because we created a world for ourselves that we don't need absolutely anybody. That's extraordinary. We don't need anybody. We are self-sufficient totally. We have one assistant. No? If not, we are doing it all ourselves. No? And that's quite extraordinary. It's like some monks in a monastery doing their art. And we do our walks in the morning. We do one walk in the morning, one in lunchtime, and the big one in the evening. And only when we have to meet somebody for the art, if not, we don't meet anybody, ever.
It's quite interesting when they say about the establishment, because we know that modern art is more important than any other form, and you can prove it, because royalty and politicians can attend horse races, football matches, opera houses, ballet, theatre, but it's much more difficult to come near a modern art exhibition openly.
Queen came here?
When the Queen opened this building, we heard from some friends of the security people that she was taking on a very circuitous route to avoid seeing our two pictures.
There was one called Kant here. Yeah.
It's the only picture of the director in the collection.
Moving swiftly on.
I thought it was marvellous seeing you actually go around your own exhibition. I was a little bit worried in case you might catch somebody bad-mouthing your work or saying something that was completely misunderstood. How sensitive are you to criticism?
To criticism?
Same as everyone else. If I was to lean over and say you're the most stupid person who's ever asked us a question and so entirely unattractive, you would be hurt, yeah?
No, I wouldn't.
But so you are quite unusual. But I mean, we are heard of it. I have a new way of dealing with it. I don't read them. That's it. I don't want to know. I only read the title. That's it.
Gilbert says, I don't want to know, but do tell me, please. So I tell him what it says in the articles.
But yes, it does hurt. Yes.
It hurts and it doesn't matter, no? Who was the leading art critic when Van Gogh was painting? I mean, they're all long dead and forgotten. They disappear. Does anyone in the audience know the name Paul Overy? Hands up anyone who knows Paul Overy, the name of. Leading critic of the Times from 1970 to 1979.
Yes. Great. And what about John Russell?
John Russell. Famous critic on both sides of the Atlantic.
For many, many years.
Many, many years. Now long forgotten. It's extraordinary. I feel sorry for them.
Sure.
You say you feel like outsiders, but you seem to be part of a real community in the East End of London. Do you feel part of that community?
Yes, very much so. As we were saying earlier, we feel like honorary Cockneys, we feel like honorary Muslims or Bangladeshis.
But we don't have anybody for tea.
That's the difference.
That's it. That's
we're not socially involved in artists or other people, yeah?
I mean, we only like waiters. That's it. That's it.
I don't know what's funny about that.
Because we can have a fantastic relationship with the waiters, no? Because they are there and they have to serve you and it's fantastic, yeah.
Even though we're surrounded by artists, we just wave and say good morning in the street like that. So now we have a show at the Tate, we can wave even better.
Hello there. Hi, my name is Sonia. You've been working together for a long time and working so closely. Do you experience times when you're in the middle of creating a big project and you completely disagree on principles and ideas, and how much do you have to compromise, and how do you talk things through?
It's the great heterosexual question, we call that. Do you argue? I think people would be jealous if they found out that we didn't argue. And we don't.
Even
if we did, we wouldn't tell you, but we don't.
But it's very simple, because we have a goal in front of us, no? And so the compromises are very little. We know exactly where we want to go because we're always together. So when we change towards something different, we very, very slowly go towards that. Both, no? We don't have to discuss it.
We don't have to be conscious.
We are moving towards that without knowing because we're always together. And so we know the end result is the most important. That's it.
Disagreement is very bad because it wastes time. It's only when agreement, and then you can go forward. Yeah? Nothing matters anyway, because when we go to the studio, we don't have ideas. If you had ideas, there probably would be an argument as to which was a good idea and which is a bad idea. When we go to the studio, we go completely dead-headed, zonk, blind, deaf, damaged, and try to find out how we are that day, how we fear, how we hope, what we dread, what we love, and make the pictures like that, just print them off from out inside of ourselves, yeah? And that we trust. That's why we never destroy pictures like a lot of artists think they're not good enough that day or not. They're all good pictures.
Well, it's very good because we found a way of a language for ourselves, no? And we keep to that. No? But we believe in the, what you call, in feeling the world anew every single day. But the language is always the same. No? And we reinvented ourselves recently with all the computers that we taught ourselves. And that's extraordinary. Yeah. Beginning of a revolution for us. It's so near to you, no? You don't have to go up and down ladders or big studios. It's just in front of you. It's just like in your brain. No? And it's just the beginning.
We used to use darkroom technology the whole time. We're developing trays and fixatures. And a lot of people think we should miss that old technology, that we should like the dark or the bulbs or the smells. But we don't. The only thing we miss is the rubber gloves. Yes, your question is a little like the people who say, it's fascinating, what is your secret? And we say, it's a secret.
You seem to describe on a number of occasions your reawakening with technology and all the images that you have stored away. And I was beginning to think a little bit about the difference between the external stimulation of the East End as was or still vaguely is and what it's becoming, and the extent to which you are relying increasingly on your own world that you have created rather than on the external world, because Fournier Street today and Stoke Newington today, let alone what it'll be as we approach the Olympics, is going to be much less of this kind of place where all the messages about what is going on in the world is represented in a microcosm. And I was just wondering whether this building your own world with your own images is an alternative to the being immersed in a place which carries with it all the dynamics of what's going on around.
We love change. It always changed, the neighborhood. It never stood still. It was never original. It was a swamp, then it was a place where returning damaged crusaders were, then it was this, then it was that. Constant change is part of the East End. We love that.
We don't need it. I mean, we can always find something different. Like we have the plane trees in the back of our house, no? They're very fascinating for us, no? We always looked up at them, and now recently we use them. And then we used to we like the Evening Standard posters, no? We collected like for 2 or 3 years, we have 2,500, all in subjects, no? It was extraordinary. It's like the most modern landscape of today, like all the murders, sex,
rapists,
all in order.
Stabbing, killing, shot, shooting.
So
no, I don't think we rely on any antique set. We're not romantic about the district, not at all. That's why we never sign a petition that's against something. Like they always want you to sign a poster to save the market. Why should you save the market? The market porters thought it was well past its date. Yeah?
Or to have the drunks out of the city.
A man at the end of the street wanted us to sign a petition against a safe house for recovering alcoholics. And we wouldn't say, he died 2 days later. they want you to sign against the prostitutes on Commercial Street. I cannot imagine a more cruel thing than to dump another problem on top of some girls who have enormous problems with sex, money, race, religion, health and things. And to have a bunch of middle-class twits chasing you is even a horrific idea, isn't it? Horrific.
With art being taken, art in the classroom and education with art being taken into computers and digital technology, how do you feel about your artwork being used within the classroom?
In the classroom?
Yeah.
Perfect. We never mind our pictures being used in that way.
All free. We never care about the copyright. Everybody can use whatever they want. Remember? Because every artwork is original. There is only one. So taking images of that artwork is just fantastic. All free catalogs, free this. We always tell to our galleries, we are not here to make money with catalogs.
Yeah.
I think that our images are available. If you go into a restaurant and you find Constable's Haywain reproduced on the table mat, there's no insult to Constable, not at all.
Even everybody's allowed to take photographs in this exhibition. We arrange that. If not,
they wouldn't be allowed to normally. Yeah? Yeah. It's very good when the museum director said we must have the sign saying no photography allowed. And we said, we really wouldn't like that. We don't think it's very democratic. No, we must have that. I said, do you know who invented it? Hitler. Okay, we take it down. Immediately done.
I take it their art is in classrooms. You have evidence of this?
In Stoke Newington High School, and they were doing a project last year using your Son of a God project.
Fantastic.
Using Photoshop, and it was really exciting to see how the year 11, 16-year-olds were using your idea for art and projecting their own ideas onto it. It was fantastic.
Children are so much more open than adults anyway. I remember when we had the Naked Ship Pictures exhibition in the South London Gallery. The lovely director, David Thorpe, was very nervous, and he wanted to have a sign, not to do with photography, he wanted to have a sign saying that all children should be accompanied by an adult to visit the exhibition. And we said, we really don't want to, we think that's insulting to children, because they're all very bright, children are as bright as adults in their own way. And he said, we really should have that. I said, you can have a sign, David, if you like, but it has to say that all adults must be accompanied by a child. He said, okay, we won't have a sign, it's fine. But it's true in a way, no? Children are much more free and much more intellectual in that open way.
I don't care.
Your very bright colour pictures from the 80s, very polished, almost look as if they're prints. Could you tell us which techniques you used to produce them, please?
Enlargers.
It's all darkroom technology. Enlarger. Photographic paper, black and white image.
And dyed.
And then dyed by
hand.
With a bowl of colour and a big
all done
cloth.
By us. We are very proud about that no assistance will be done from the beginning to the end is done by us.
But you famously had assistants, including...
We used to have gummers when we did the darkroom technology, yes.
But very little. Very. Is.
They did very, very little, in fact. We drew the line and they had to fill it in.
And they had to fill, they had to, what they call, like paint a surface where the colour wouldn't go through. No? We would make a line, outer line.
Like a wax resist. We used to call it liquid condom.
That's it. Yeah. But now we don't have to do even that.
We have one lovely young Chinese assistant, Yu Yigang, and he does the scanning that we don't need to do.
Is he the same guy who...
Yes, he followed us from China.
Yeah, followed us from Shanghai.
Followed us from Shanghai, yes.
Is he the same guy who went to Brian Sewell's house?
No, that's
another young man. I'm talking Brian Sewell.
You've just reminded me.
It's a very good Sewell story, because we had a young photographer came to take a portrait of us for some magazine one day. And it was one of the first jobs that he'd done. So he was carrying all of his equipment. He didn't have an assistant. He didn't know London very well, but he was trying to be a proper photographer. And as he left the house, he fumbled with the sheet of paper with our address on and found the address of the next person he had to go and take a portrait of, and it was Kensington, 10 Kensington Gardens or something. He wanted to know which tube to take, so we gave him directions, and all he had to do was to take a headshot of Brian Sewell, because they had to update him in the standard. Yeah? So off he went. By chance, 2 or 3 weeks later, we met that young man on the street, and we said, did you get to that next address all right the last time? And he said, yes, in a very mysterious way. I said, what happened? He said, I arrived at the house on time. I rang the bell, and after a few moments, the door opened, and there was Brian Sewell, naked. Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that interesting? Slow down.
Interesting and libelous. I think it's now we've gone over a little bit. Can we have one more question? Is that okay? Anyone out there? Right up at the back, yeah. Back row.
You talked a bit just now about sort of finding your visual language and sticking with it and running with it after you'd figured out the kind of pictures you wanted to make or the kind of language. But I was thinking, actually looking through the catalogue more than the show, that I wondered how you thought about your early work before you'd arrived at that visual language that you stuck with so persistently. What does it mean to you now? Does it feel
experimental?
Experimental.
Just experimental.
The early ones.
Were you looking for something, or did you stumble on it? Or?
All of the Charco works, people love them because they're so certain classes of people prefer them to the other ones. but yes, they're handmade, but they're taken from photographic images, in fact.
But we did experiment every single day in different ways. Even we started to make films at the beginning. We thought maybe we would move towards filmmaking or even
pop
like
world.
Pop world. We did that. Mm?
Yeah.
And then we did, yes, and then we did drawings or painting.
Postal sculpture.
And then we started very, very slow to use this images, photographic images, because they were more powerful and more real. Mm? But we didn't know how to make a big picture after that, so we scattered them around, like a lot of different images to make a big picture, and then we pushed them all together and created a form that we are using now.
Are you fond of them, the early works?
We're fond of them as early experiments, yes.
Mm. Yes, we like it because it's quite nostalgic, and we can see how innocent we were.
No, she tells me.
Can you just end? The best story I've heard about the show is this. You told me earlier about Sandra, the famous landlady from...
Oh, yes, there's a public house on Commercial Street near us.
George found it.
Run by Sandra and her husband Dennis. And they were a very unsuccessful pub for many years. Nobody went there. And then we went in and we introduced some artists. And Sandra became very, very fond of art and artists and designers and ballet dancers. She loved the idea. It was something new to her. And she embraced that whole world of the arts and became now an international success. She's probably the most famous landlady in the world, probably, as a running pub. Yeah? But the husband was always a little bit different and set back and didn't quite see the point of the whole thing, although he realized it was a success. But they came to the private view the other evening, and coming out of the exhibition onto the concourse, having seen the whole of the exhibition, coming up to us, and Sandra said, "Darlings, darlings, you've blown Dennis's mind. I don't know what to think. He's had to close his eyes. He's a new man." It's quite exciting.
Yeah.
And he?
I think on that great note.
Wonderful.
Many thanks to Gilbert and George. I hope you enjoyed this.